Welcome to the SDR Disco Call Vidcast and Podcast, a show designed for brand new sales reps working in the world of tech sales. I'm your host, Neil Buyan, and I'm going to be taking you on a journey on the SDR Disco Call Vidcast and Podcast. Did you know that you can watch this show live with the guests on YouTube? This show is available on YouTube at happyselling.io. Hello, listeners and watchers and subscribers to the SDR Disco Call Show. We really appreciate you joining, and if you're a returning guest, thank you for joining us again. However, if this is your first time and you're wondering what the hell is this all about, so the SDR Disco Call Show is a show for those that are working in the world of tech sales and a role called sales development, where we're prospecting, reaching out to leads and trying to get them interested in our business. And what we love to do is meet interesting people to find out their journeys, their stories, to give insights, to encourage more people to come into this beautiful industry that we all love. And my name is Neil Buyan. If you're listening to this in your local podcast platform, a big ask would be to give us a rating and subscribe. And if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, to help with the algorithm, please give us a like, comment, and subscribe down below. Now, the guest that I have on today is a really cool person that I've wanted to have on the show for a little while, and it was a referral given to me by Ashley Ormond. So Ashley, big shout out to you, mate. But without further ado, guest, could you tell us, who are you, where are you based in the world, where do you work, and what do they do?
Yes, thanks. My name's Dave Wilkins. I'm British, but I live in the Netherlands. I'm just a little bit outside of Amsterdam. And I'm the founder of a community called SDR Leaders of EMEA. The whole point of it is leaders in the sales development world are often alone. And then in EMEA, they're even more alone. Their bosses are out in the sticks over in the United States. So it's about giving people coaching, mentorship, and a community to be with each other.
I love it. Well, David, an absolute privilege and pleasure to have you on board, and thank you so much for joining. And you're a Brit based out in Dam, and you're the SDR leaders, to an extent, best friend. You're their support. Yeah, you're their guidance out there, right? I absolutely love that. So a question that I love to ask all my guests, David, is, outside of sales, what floats your boat? And that's actually quite cool for Amsterdam. But what floats your boat? What hobbies and passions and interests do you have, sir?
Yeah, I got told a story about boats. The best two times about having a boat is the day that you buy a boat and the day that you sell the boat. So that's always the issue with getting boats in the Netherlands. So I try and avoid them. So what do I get up to? I live in the countryside just outside of Amsterdam. So we go on a lot of walks with our dog, Chucky, into the forests and stuff, and yeah, just like to stay fit and try and stay fit at least, and just enjoy living life.
Couldn't have said it better. I love that. Absolutely. Shout out to Chucky as well. So what we like to do at this point with the show is visit our guest's LinkedIn profile, and as a gentle reminder that all of our guests' profiles will be within the show notes, so that if you want to connect with them, pick their brains on anything that we've discussed today. And obviously with David and the crew that he's running, they've got a lot of great resources for SDR leaders out there. But again, David, you put out quite a lot of good posts, and highly again recommend following David out there as well. But if we go down to the career, you've had a colorful career, sir. So if we go way back in the day, we can see yourself working at Palo Alto Networks out in the Dam. You've been an inside sales rep at Double Dutch, you know, InflowBlocks, Solus, Snowflake, you know, part of Pavilion, Clay. I want to learn more about that as well. An advisor in a few places. And obviously for the past 8 months or so, you've been helping out with SDR's Leaders of EMEA. And it was quite cool because when we connected, you said you're a Brit living out in the Dam. I was like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that. But what is your story, David? Like, how did you get into sales? Could you walk us through all those career paths, and how did you get to where you are today, sir?
Yeah, I think the basis of it is, so I suffer quite badly from dyslexia. And so at school, I can articulate very well. I can speak on lots of topics, but ask me to write, no chance. And so at the age of, I wanted to do my A levels.
I'm going to go right to the beginning.
Please do. Bring us back.
Yeah. Once I did my A levels, I wasn't ready to do A levels, but I also I failed my first year at college, so I had to move colleges. I actually moved then to a rugby playing school, a state school, and then I was like, okay, I've got to figure out where to go to university, and I picked the university that had the lowest entry grades possible because I was just so scared about not doing well at my exams. Luckily, I did do that because I got exactly those grades. And then I went to this university and then I was like, well, if I'm going to get a job, like a proper job, then in 2009, it was like, oh, we're going to go get a job at Audi, get on their graduate training scheme, get an Audi. I was like, I need to do something else. Like, I need to go to do it. We had the Erasmus scheme where you go and do 6 months at another university. So I went to Amsterdam for that. And so I said I went to a rugby playing school when I was younger. So I was quite good at rugby. And so I ended up playing rugby over in Amsterdam whilst I was still at school at university here. And then when I graduated, the coach had moved to a city called Utrecht, which is not that far from Amsterdam.
Yep.
I was just like, hey, do you want to come and play for me over there? So since 2009, apart from 2 years in the middle, I've lived in the Netherlands. And then those 2 years in the middle, I moved to the UK. I thought I should get a real job, no longer living the dream of being a rugby player. So I wanted to get into teaching. I worked at a city state school in Leicester. That's where I'm from originally, for a year. That was a really interesting experience. And then I ended up going to work at a private school in the north of England to be a PE teacher and rugby coach. And it was lovely. It was great. But I just loved the Netherlands. So I moved back. I had €700 in my pocket because I'd wrote off my car whilst driving in the North Yorkshire moors. Didn't realise that deer in headlights is like an actual saying. And when I was flickering my headlights to get the deer to move, they didn't move. I worked at some mayonnaise factories, a mayonnaise factory here in the Netherlands. I worked at some other stuff and ended up at a company called Palo Alto Networks in 2013. I was told about a job called a business development representative. I had no idea what Palo Alto was. I had no idea what a business development representative was. And I got the job somehow. and there we go. Then we started.
I love that. So many little like nuances going through, like with as you mentioned, with the dyslexia and the worry of what grades are needed in order to get into further education, and then doing your Erasmus, being able to go out to Dam, checking that out, coming back at home looking for, you know, what you would deem like a real job, going into teaching also with the rugby side of it as well, having, you know, the incident with the car with the deer in the headlights, and then, you know, loving Dam. So I'm also curious to know, because I love the Netherlands and I love Amsterdam, what was the appeal to you at that young age about Dam? There's some of our viewers may think, well, actually, I think I know why he likes that place, but I want to know from David, like, what was the attraction of Dam?
The way of life. So brought up in Leicester. One of the reasons why Dutch people don't understand my Dutch is because I still speak in a Leicester accent when I'm still trying to speak Dutch. I can't get rid of it. Just having the ability just to have a work-life balance. My friends at the time who I went to school with, they still all live around Leicestershire. They do the 9 to 5. They have to leave at 7. They get back at 6, 7. And I didn't want to get into that routine and that rhythm. So I just moved, and you know, it was also just at the time of the economic crash as well. So it was like, okay, there's nothing available here. It was just that way of life. And when you've got the ability to be door to door an hour from work and you know that train's going to run on time, that they run, because they run four times a day, an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you can cycle to the train station, and then you can cycle from the train station to your office. Like, it's just, it just creates just this calmness in you. So.
Yeah, it is a different way of life, because I've been to Dam quite a lot of times, and I was an SDR manager about 2 years back for a company called Happio. And it was just coming out of lockdown and the pandemic where I got to go visit and be with the team. I'd spend like a couple of days out there. But just, and again, big shout out to all my Dutch friends. But it's just so much calmer. There's so much more polite. Things run on time. Things make sense. There's just no ag. And I can understand it's a different way of life to, like, say, within the UK. And sometimes your friends and family, they don't get that vibe of, you know, when you go to a new place and you're working out there. But which is, you know, again, love working out in Dam. But then coming back to 2013, joining this tech company, Palo Alto Networks, not knowing what this BDR role is or what this is all about. Because funnily enough, it was in around the same time, that's when I joined my first tech company, and I didn't know what a enterprise business representative meant or and all of that stuff. So tell me, what was going through young David's mind of tech, Palo Alto, and, you know, doing something different?
Yeah, so I started at the same time as a mutual acquaintance of ours, Dave Inskip. So we both started at the same time. Shout out to Dave. Dave was a lot more mature than I at that stage. He knew what was going on in terms of this world we're entering. I just had no clue.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that, like, for example, Palo Alto had just gone IPO the year before, that they were the big cybersecurity brand in the world. I was just like, yeah, whatever.
It's a job.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, for example, they said, oh, you're going to have to go to San Francisco for onboarding. And I was just like, yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. And then I got my boss at times like, Dave, why have you not booked your tickets? You have to go like in 2 weeks. And I was like, oh, it's real. And you're what's going on?
Yeah.
I did okay. I was not bad at it, but I also got really badly concussed like 3 months after starting. It was like I was still playing rugby when I came back, but I got really badly concussed, like, and it was my third one in like 6 weeks, 7 weeks. And so I couldn't look at a screen. It was that bad. So I stopped playing rugby then, finally. It was a massive wake up call. And I do regret not taking better advantage of the situation than I did.
Thank you for sharing. And I completely slipped my mind that we both know David Inskip. And it's funny that you said, like, this guy who knew what he was doing, he knew the whole world. I felt exactly the same way with David when I joined Showpad, because we joined at that company in 2015 at the same time. And I was on the cusp of wanting to become an account executive, but I wasn't too sure. But David knew what the hell he wanted. He knew how, and he was very well spoken, very articulate. And I used to look up to him in his beard and think, like, that's a man. But yeah, no, I love that. But, you know, coming to this thing of, you know, Palo Alto and not knowing that it just IPO'd, it was this big cybersecurity, like, tech company. And then your manager saying, like, Dave, 2 weeks, you need to go out to the US. Come on, let's pick up. I think I had a similar experience. My manager was Kat, and she said, we're booking you tickets to San Francisco. I was like, what? And we're going to fly you out there. And it wasn't until, and I've said this on the show before, that I arrived at San Francisco and my manager had booked me a car, like a rental car from Hertz. And I'd only realized when I got off the plane, wait a minute, they drive on the other side of the road and the steering wheel's on the other side. And I got onto the 101 and I was stuck on the 101 freeway for 2 hours because I didn't know how to come off. And then I finally made it to my hotel. I remember driving to Redwood City's office the following morning.
Yeah.
And I got there really early because I'm still on UK time zone on my sleep. But I got there for about 7 a.m. when it was about an 8:30 start. But I remember sitting in the car and looking at the office and thinking, I'm in Silicon Valley and I'm in California. this is probably going to all end in a couple of weeks. They're going to fire me and realize I'm not the real Neil Buchan for this tech company. I don't know. But were there any sort of doubts or worries of like, this is all just going to pop in a bubble? It's a dream and it's just not going to work out. I don't know. How did you feel back then?
Oh, I still feel like that way now.
Yeah.
It's like, when are we going to get found out?
And now I'm
now at the point in my career where it's like, okay, I think we're good. I think you actually are now, you've got some evidence to back up your claims. I felt really uncomfortable in every single role that I had. All the way through. And I think it's natural. I think because there's imposter syndrome. Yeah, absolutely. But also, if you're not feeling uncomfortable in a role, then it shows that the role is not challenging enough for you. And you've got to have that feel of like, not like I'm going to lose my job tomorrow, but this thing of like, I need to continue to do better and improve. And I think if you hit that plateau where it's like, okay, this job's easy, whatever, then it's like, okay, well, maybe you've got golden handcuffs and there is some sort of long-term incentive plan that you're staying for. Okay, then stay for that. But if not, then you should be looking for another role, or internally or externally.
Yeah. Thank you. And I think you're right. There is that element of imposter syndrome, but I agree with you, doing things to get you out of your comfort zone, which helps you grow. And, you know, I've coached a lot of people where things get tough maybe the first 3 or 6 months and it's all new and it's a little bit scary and they think they want to like throw the towel in. But if they just stay a little bit longer and knowing that this is all new and this is all weird, but, you know, you'll get there eventually. But even now, like where I am today, anytime something hard comes along or if somebody asks me to do something I haven't done for the first time, rather than get worried about, I'm like, okay, this is new. I'm probably not going to be great at it when I first start it out, but let's just give it a go and see where we get to. And I think contrasting back when we were younger and worrying about, are we going to be fit for this? It does hold you in good stead when you're older. And I think I look for stuff that scares me now. I think that's more fun, right?
Exactly. But
please.
Sorry, one other anecdote. I was, maybe we'll go to Infobox in a minute, but
yeah,
A friend of mine, I said when I was at Infoblox, like, oh, I'm not quite sure about this place. And then she said something that really stuck with me. She said, you can't quit again. And I was just like, oh, okay, right. And I think that was the piece that, you know, that kind of just matured me pretty immediately. Like, just like, you can't quit again. And that was a real wake-up call for me. And yeah, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a little bit.
100%. Well, let's dive into it. So I can see, you know, you was at Palo Alto for a year. You went to Double Dutch, which you used there for 2 years as an inside sales rep. And then I could see 5 years at Infoblox as a director of business development. So tell me about, what was that transition going into Infoblox? What was that all about? And to, you know, when that peer was telling you, you can't quit again, what happened?
Yeah. So I started out Infoblox as a BDR for ease of reading. I just did the end title on LinkedIn. But 5 years, I went from BDR to individual contributor, to manager, to senior manager, to director, to running global initiatives and strategies. The ramp, the liftoff was just incredible. So it took me about 18 months to finally get comfortable as a BDR at Infoblox. And then it was really interesting. The moment it clicked for me that I actually felt I belonged, I was at my second SKO with the business, sales kickoff for the business. I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. Right, I'm good. I've got this. But yeah, my friend was from a academic background, so she didn't. But she was also like, because I went from three companies in the space of 3 years, three and a half years, and so, you know, she's about tenure and staying at the place.
Yeah,
and yeah, I was just on a call with her 2 months in, And we were just chatting, and she said, like, yeah, I said, like, oh, I'm not sure if this is the right place. And she was like, yeah, you can't quit. And yeah, so I just stuck at it, and then things started getting better. And then, yeah, I had some really good leaders that saw potential in me, like Sharif Sleeman, Malcolm Murphy, Katja van Trecht, Lawrence Morrison, Frank Rouge. They all saw potential in me and helped me accelerate to leaving as a second line leader running global projects.
Awesome. I love that. So something within that I think I'd love to get your opinion on to help out with the audience for anybody that's listening or watching. So sometimes people can see the potential in you, you know, they can see that you're going to go on to do great things. But there comes a point within ourselves where we have self-doubt. We wonder if we've taken the right job or if perhaps we're going to be any good at this, and we don't know. In that moment when we're being tough on ourselves, what advice would you give to somebody that may be going through the same thing? And then the other side of the coin is when you as a leader see the potential in somebody else, but they don't see it, how do you help them?
Yeah, the first question, I think it comes down to experience, having years in the job, having been able, something that one of my mentors said when I was in for blocks was like, you're not going to know how to react in certain situations until it's happened. And when I became a manager for the first time, it really opened my eyes to human behavior because I was immature, yes, but I was a good kid. But then when I became into a manager role and I just saw this breadth of human behavior, I was like, oh, okay, this is how people really react and talk to each other. And then you have that all the way through when you become a global leader, and then you're trying to understand how C-level people work and all that. So I think the big thing for me was around just sitting down and writing stuff out, writing negatives and positives. But then also speaking to people that you trust and get their feedback on what you've written down and get their view. I was at InfoBlocks for 5.5 years. I'm sure I could still be there right now. If I wanted to be, I hope, Frank, if you're seeing this. It got to the point where I was like, okay, it's time to move on. It's time for a new challenge. I want to, try something different. But that was, again, it was writing out those pros and cons for doing that and making that move.
Yeah. And it's like making, an informed decision, weighing it all up and seeing, rather than just being brash, because again, things are run on emotion, which is our irrational thinking. And then we need to rationalize it by weighing up those pros and cons, right? And on the second side, that question where you're a leader and you see a potential in somebody, but they can't yet see it in themselves. Sometimes I'm thinking they have to realize I can't force it upon them, right? But to kind of tease it out of them or help them come to that conclusion, what's worked in your experience, Dave?
Yeah, so I'll give a really good example. And I'll give a shout out to Lizzie Reeves, who told me, I don't know if this is embargoed, it shouldn't be by the time this comes out. She's been promoted to run APAC and EMEA at Solace on the SDR side. We brought her in during COVID as a fresh, straight out of university SDR and super, super smart. Law degree, like just super smart. But she's young, straight out of university and just wide world, crazy. But you could tell that she just had a process, structure. You saw in those private moments that she was a mature, level-headed person who could articulate complex problems and stuff. And so I saw that, right, straight away, she's going to be the next leader of this group. I'm really proud of her to see how she's grown over the last 3+ years now to be running 2 GOs for a company, how the maturity in her, I've said this to her to her face as well. So this isn't coming as a surprise to her, but it's very tough as a British person to be give people this honest how I really feel about someone. But yeah. it was like, but again with her, a lot of self-doubt, a lot of I'm not sure this is what I want to do, this is where I want to be, this is too much. But it was just like, okay, let's take the emotion out of it and let's start talking about what your end goal is and what you need to be doing. Yeah, that's something I'm really proud of.
I love that. And, you know, like with, you know, being a leader and having reps where they do self-doubt themselves, I think part of me initially thinks I've been there, so I know what that feels like and I know what you're thinking as well. And then, you know, helping them have the conversation of, okay, what are you worried about this? And, okay, what's worst case scenario that could happen if it doesn't work? And all of those things. But, you know, you're still here. You still have a role. And the other thing that I realized as a coach the other week, which kind of surprised me, was there's a leader that I've been coaching for over a year. And they're thinking about maybe transitioning into a different path altogether. So out of leadership, right, going into an individual contributor role. And they said, you've done that, Neil. What was your experience like? I just want to hear your story. And I told them the story and we went through it. And then I told them the honest realities of like, look, if you really want to make a good wedge of cash, an individual contributor role is great. But if you get happiness from helping other people grow and becoming rich, then leadership's a really good place. But do know that you may earn less as a leader than you may do as an individual contributor. And at the end of the conversation, they just said, I needed to hear that. I just needed the permission to be okay, I can go for it. And when I said, what do you mean permission? I said, I just needed to hear it from you. And I was like, you don't need my permission to go do that. She said, no, it's not so much the permission, but I just needed to soundboard it out with you. But it kind of struck a chord in me that sometimes as leaders, your reps may look up to your words or, you know, take it with a lot of weight. So I think, as a former leader, sometimes you have to be mindful of how you speak to your reps, right? But any tips for having conversations with your reps when you're building them up, or, you know, when you're speaking to leaders, say, because, you know, that's what you guys are doing at the minute. Yeah. Like, how do you help those leaders come to those conclusions or make sure that they feel they're doing it from their place?
Yeah, really good question. So the a mentor of mine, Malcolm Murphy, he used to do this really, something that I thought was really annoying. Used to get really frustrated where if I asked him a question, he would ask me a question back. And then I'd give him the answer and then he would give me another question. And then I'd be like, come on, Malcolm, come on. But I got it in the end. It took a while, but I got it in the end where it was like he wanted me to go through the flow of, he knew I knew the answer, but he wanted me to think about it in a more deliberate way.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I try and do now with in the leadership roles that I was in, was try not to give people the answer, because that's the easy thing. Come to the Oracle Dave, he will give wisdom and give you the answer, and then they don't grow, and then people wonder why am I not growing and developing. And so it's trying to give people do that way and getting them to answer the question. Now, what I find really interesting though is I've been in some companies where you do that approach and the people who are reporting to you, they don't have that level of emotional intelligence and emotional maturity. And they start really not, like I got frustrated with Malcolm, I clicked, but some people just go like, that they don't come to you because you're not going to give them the answer that they want. And so that's also a challenge as well about how, when to employ that strategy if people are really ready for it. That's all good learning.
It is indeed. I think in a lot of coaching conversations, we've got a lot of coaches where I know they just want the answers to the questions. And I'll always preface it with, David, you know, I do have the answer and I do really want to give it to you, but you know me, I'm not going to give it to you straight away. I just want to understand your thought process behind it a little bit before we come. Because 9 times out of 10, once I've teased it out of them, they've already thought about the thing that I was already going to say to them anyway. But there have been instances where I've had it with reps or people that I'm coaching where I'm like, they don't get it. They can't get to it. And I've tried every question of getting them to try to come to the conclusion. And then I'm like, right, I have to switch here and said, okay, so in my experience, this is what you would do. Yeah. But I think the way that I end the conversation is, how would you see that working for you? Or how would you do it in your world? So I try to get them to start, you know, thinking independently. But yeah, sometimes you have to kind of decide, when do you give the answer? But most of the time you don't want to give the answer. You want them to come to the conclusion, right? 100%. So with looking back on here, so you've worked at, like you mentioned, some place like Solace, Snowflake. What was it like at Snowflake? Because they're a big org and they were a big name as well. What was it like being, you know, director of sales development EMEA there?
Yeah, insane. It was like, I mean, so I was a global leader at Solace. And then when Lars Nielsen, who was VP of sales development at Snowflake, he's the man in Silicon Valley around sales development. He comes calling, you know, you've got to go under that learning tree. So it was really interesting to be at it would have been similar to if I was at Parlo. Like it was that kind of environment, but now actually responsible for 7 or 8 managers and 60 SDRs reporting underneath me, and then have dotted lines with SDR operations and SDR enablement. It was just this whole business unit, just bigger than maybe some other sales organizations. And it was great. It was really that kind of, I class it as kind of like that finishing school where you are in a huge enterprise organization where, you know, you're seeing the stock tracker, you're seeing what's going on there, but then also how you know that you're playing a real critical piece of how to build this business and continue to scale this business post IPO. So it was,
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing. So what I want to come into now is understanding a little bit more about SDR leaders of EMEA, David. Like, what was the thought process? What was the journey? And then after that, would love to dive into like what you guys currently are doing to help out the other SDR leaders. So what's the story, David?
Yeah, so it was in the Netherlands, they say that during New Year's Eve, they have this huge thing about fireworks. So if you're a Dutch person, you're saving money from now on, from August until December, so you can buy massive fireworks.
Yeah.
And in some villages, in some towns, they have firework bans because emergency services are like, it goes crazy.
Yeah.
It's really crazy. So my village, they said we had a fireworks ban. And I was like, yeah, sure, believe that. It didn't happen because I was sleeping on my couch holding my dog who was just in the fetal position for hours. But I was like, I'm going to take him for a walk before it gets really crazy. And so I'm just walking up a hill, the only hill in the village, because we obviously everything's flat here. And I was like, that's the problem. If you're an SDR leader in EMEA, you don't have anybody to talk to. You might have a peer, like another manager that you work with, but very unlikely. You're going to be alone on this island of EMEA. Your boss is going to be in the States and they're going to be West Coast. You're going to have sales and marketing who are trying to drive their agendas. And then you're going to have SDRs that you just don't know how to deal with. Because normally a new first-time leader. And so I was like, okay, well, why don't I just set up a community just to see what happens? And I thought if I get 150 people in a year, then great, we're golden and that's great and people can collaborate. And then I ended up getting like 100 people in a week, less than a week.
Jeez.
In LinkedIn, a LinkedIn group. LinkedIn is really unhelpful. And I hope you hear this, LinkedIn, because you were really inflexible. So I put the group as public by accident, and I wanted it to go private so we could have real conversations. They were like, no, not possible. It's not possible. And I'm just like, okay, bro, I'll go to Slack. No problem. So I moved straight over to Slack, and now we're at Yeah, we've got 2,000+ members in our company, in our, in our community, in LinkedIn. And then we've got about 700 odd in our Slack group. Mm-hmm. And in our Slack group, that's where all the action is. It's like we have a really engaging, busy group. I think the big things about Slack groups is that everybody joins them and there's nothing happens.
Yeah.
And this one, the way I say it is I never have to put like start conversations because there's always comments on what about this tech or we're looking to do hiring here or, and then we have a really big jobs board where people are looking for managers, directors, also SDRs and people putting CVs in.
Yeah.
It's a really buzzing place. We've got virtual events that we run. We'd like bi-weekly, fortnightly, or every month. So there's a lot of kind of sessions that we do on LinkedIn within our community.
Yeah,
and just
sharing it for all the listeners to watch. So again, ladies and gents, I will be putting the links into the show notes so you can just definitely check it out. But yeah, like you said, virtual events, like you're networking with each other, you're doing a lot of things together, and you're just you're bringing this community together. There, right, Dave?
100%, and that's the big thing. The in-person events is our big thing that we're really wanting to drive because since COVID, there hasn't that real in-person networking kind of died away.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, right, let's set this up again. Let's get leaders together. So we had a real successful one in Amsterdam and London in June, and we're back off on the road in October trying to meet as many leaders as possible.
And again, I'll be definitely putting in links for these events to check it out. But it's cool to see that, you know, as you said, being the island, not having that support as a first-time leader, also working with your SDRs. And again, if your management's out in the US on the West Coast, you feel isolated, right? And connecting these people. Because there are a lot of great minds. Like I've met a lot of great SDR leaders and SDRs where collectively they can help out. Because here's the funny thing that I found, Dave. If we go back to Palo Alto 2013 and when I was at Zora 2013, a lot of us never spoke to our equals on LinkedIn. We just didn't do it. Like I wouldn't talk to other SDRs in another tech company, or I wouldn't speak to another SDR. I don't know what it was. It wasn't ingrained in us to connect and network as much as we do. But what I'm really happy to see is things such as SDR Leaders of Mir, where it's a normal thing nowadays. So where I see reps from Cognizant talking to somebody maybe from ZoomInfo, or you know, you go to one of these networking events. Because I think I was a little dubious with, and I said this to James Ski once, I was a little dubious about these networking events because I personally don't like getting too clicky with the same people all the time. I want to kind of always change it up and everything.
Yeah.
But can you think any reason why we didn't do it as much back then as we do now?
I think it's tribalism. I think it was our box is the best box.
And
I don't know where that came from. I think it was maybe just that kind of the marketing spiel at the time about how we were trying to be the best.
Number one.
And I think there was a little bit of that. I also think as well, I think COVID did a lot in terms of putting barriers up with people. And so you and I would be in the office five times a week, always there, always just chatting to people, learning from one another. And then COVID put this block straight away.
And so we'll
never go back to 5 days a week, but it's going to be hybrid. But the other piece as well is that kind of in-office piece, it gives you that kind of social osmosis where you're connecting and engaging with people, and if that disappeared. And so I think the rise in communities as well is people going, actually, I do miss talking to people. I do miss interacting with people. I want to meet people. And you know, I think, you know, that's why the community has really exploded, is because people want to talk with one another and collaborate. And if they're not sure about a question, ask the group rather than just being suffering in silence.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think you're right, because working collectively and irregardless of what company you work for. I think back then, like you're right, we're the whole thing, we're the best box, we are the best company, we're working 5 days a week, we're ingrained in that business where we've got blinkers on. And to your point, when the pandemic happened and after that, people wanted to connect, they wanted that human connection. So it's really cool to see nowadays on LinkedIn where, you know, leaders or reps are becoming besties outside of work as well, and the collaboration piece. Because, you know, if I go back 10 years ago, none of this sort of stuff was happening, but it's really heartwarming to see, right? But a question for you, sir. So imagine I'm an SDR leader on an island in EMEA, and, you know, I feel like I'm drowning on this island. What would you say to that person, and how would you introduce SDR leaders of EMEA to them?
So I think first of all, you're not alone. Those feelings that you're having are completely natural, and there is 4,000 SDR leaders in EMEA who are also feeling the same as you. So there is and then 2,000 of those are in our LinkedIn, in our community, that can help answer those questions for you, because they have been down that road. They've experienced what you're experiencing. They can give you their take on how to deal with it. Not in a global sense, but in a, this is how in EMEA, we've handled this in the past. So the nuance that you have and the language nuance that you have. So it's that piece of there are people there that want to help you and support you. And if that's the case, just drop me a message on LinkedIn and I'll tell you all about it and help you answer those questions that you have.
I love that. And I think another important question to put to you is, because I can imagine there are some SDR leaders where they see these think tanks or groups or communities, and they may feel intimidated because of the size of it, or they may feel, I haven't been a leader long enough to come to these groups, or I haven't got anything to offer. Any words of advice to them?
Yeah, we're just like you. We're all struggling. We all don't know. We all have imposter syndrome. I still have it every day. And I'm wondering when I'm gonna F up and stuff every single day. So we all feel it, and like we can't help you do your job, your day to day job. But what we can do is we can tell you, hey, what is the path that we've followed and how we've achieved or done things, and you can learn from that as well. And I think that's the big thing, is this, where the group is trying to pave a path to make the path to leadership smoother. We're not gonna drive you there, but we're gonna make that path smoother for you and give you those road signs to help you become better leaders. That's the core goal.
I love that. Thank you so much. So it's been an absolute pleasure to finally get you on the show, David. And I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. If we were to go back to that young David Wilkins, who maybe just before the Palo Alto, perhaps when, you know, you thought to yourself, I have to go get a real job now. And there's that young guy standing there, not sure of himself or what's going to happen. What 3 bits of advice would you give to that younger David Wilkins?
You are actually talented at something. That was the big thing, not actually knowing if I was actually talented to do anything ever. It's going to be rocky, but the path is still going up. Even though it's a rocky path, you're still going to achieve what you want to achieve. Yeah, trust people. There are good people out there. You know, trust them. Don't be closed off and be untrustworthy, because there are people that really do want to help you just in the goodness of their own heart.
I love that. Thank you very much, David. And are there any shout outs or kudos that you'd like to give?
Lizzie Reeves is doing a great job as an SDR leader for Solis in the UK. Yeah, just I've mentioned a couple of the people like Malcolm Murphy. They've been great mentors. Sharif Sleeman, Frank Rouge, Lawrence Morrison, and Katri Bantrecht, all great people. Some of the best of humanity. Shout outs to them.
Love that. Straight from the heart, David. I absolutely love that. So also a massive thank you to our listeners, watchers and subscribers for joining us on David's chapter today here on the SDR Disco Call Show. As a big ask, make sure that if you're listening to this in your local podcast platform, that you give us a rating, like, and share with anybody that you think could benefit from this episode. And equally, if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, help us out with the algorithm. Give us a like, comment, subscribe down below. David's details and LinkedIn profile and everything about SDR Leaders of EMEA will be in the show notes and also on our website. So please check them out. Give them a follow. And they're also on TikTok as well. So make sure you follow them on there as well. But David Wilkins, thank you so much for joining on today's episode. I'm wishing you a positive weekend out in the Dan and a happy selling, my man.